This episode of Hodinkee Radio is proudly brought to you by the Hodinkee Shop and our impressive collection of the latest and greatest from Zenith watches, including the sporty and historic El Primero Revival G381 Limited Edition. Stay tuned for more information or visit shop.hodinkee.com to view the entire Zenith collection. Hey, it's me, James Stacey, and today's episode is a bit of FOMO service as a good portion of the watch industry recently converged in the desert for the 2021 edition of Dubai Watch Week. I've never been to Dubai Watch Week, or indeed Dubai, and as such, I'm quite curious about the event and kind of the general vibe. To help fill in the blanks and establish some context for what seems to be an out-of-the-norm show, I've called upon my pal Robin Swithinbank, who did attend this year and wrote a couple of stories about the goings-on for Hodinkee. We're also joined by Jack, who has been to Dubai Watch Week in past years and always delights as a co-host. Let's get to it. Robin, Jack, welcome back to the show. How are we doing?
Good, thank you, James. Good to be here.
Doing great. Thank you so much for having us on, James.
Oh, it's a treat to have both of you on, of course. Robin, I guess the last one you were on was for the Braemont Wing chat and the launch of the ENG 300 and all that. So we're back with like actual watch industry news. It's not just a chit-chat about death or taxes or, you know, cork-based coffins, as Jack and I sometimes get into on the show. Robin, you actually went to Dubai Watch Week. That's kind of the main topic for the chat today. How was the show? Maybe we start with what is Dubai Watch Week? Because it's one of these ones that have kind of cropped up in the last few years. And looking at your story, it seems to be growing in both its kind of weight and impact in the industry.
Yeah, I think so. Both in measurable terms and in slightly less measurable terms. I mean, the most measurable term is the number of people who went. It's a biennial event. So the last one was in 2019. They didn't skip a beat for the pandemic. They have a horology forum concept, which is lots of panels, which they do try and take around the world in the intervening years. And obviously that last year, that was digital. But the actual physical event in Dubai only happens every 2 years. And so the cycle was unbroken. There were 16,000 people there this year, which was up from 9,000 2 years ago. So that's quite significant growth for an event of that size. It's organized and hosted by Ahmed Siddiqui and Sons, which is the Middle East's biggest watch and jewelry retailer. And the concept was sort of born as an environment for watch lovers to gather in and have pretty open conversations and just sort of behave like almost like a really large red bar gathering, if you like. And it had one or two brands involved to start with. Moser were there. I was talking to Edouard Melin this year at the event, and he was remembering that year one, which I wasn't at. Year one was obviously quite a small affair, quite bijou, really. And it's still quite bijou, but there were more than 40 brands there this year. And among their number were Rolex and Hublot and Audemars Piguet. Tudor had their own booth. And then there's this sort of tent that has really quite small booths, you know, big enough for two or three people to stand on, really very small. Not forget Baselworld and the like. It's not on that scale at all. And in that tent, you can walk up and down it in 30 seconds if you stretch your legs. But in the meantime, you'll pass these sort of 30-odd brands who just have a couple of cases and maybe a local representative there. It's not a commercial fair. They're not sort of there to sell, in theory. I mean, obviously, sales are happening, maybe not transactionally on site. But a lot of the brands will meet punters who come in through the door, who have the entrance is very straightforward. I believe it's just an email, and you get a ticket. Very open event in that respect. And if you're walking through that tent and you see a watch you like, then you will no doubt be encouraged to skip over to the local Siddiqui retailer and pick up your watch. So there's plenty going on. But no, really, the spirit of it is about the conversations and the chance encounters and the, as I said in my piece, the not-so-secret assignations that take place at the event. And those happen in a number of ways, very formally. So there is the Horology Forum is the biggest venue, and there's a stage with seating for four or five panelists, and I think there were eight, maybe 10 different panels this year, all looking at themes that are dominating the watch industry at the moment, be that sustainability or how we're collecting or the domination of certain brands or the way cryptocurrency, Bitcoin and NFTs are creeping into the story as well. So quite interesting topics. And then some of it's much less formal. It's the lunch at Cipriani where you see Jean-Fred Dufour sitting next to F.P. Jean, just chewing the cud. Quite bizarre, really. I mean, these sort of things, I'm sure, happen all over the place, but none of us actually see them behind closed doors at Baselworld or lost somewhere up in the hills of the Jura Mountains. So Baselworld sort of peels back the layers of the onion and gives you a little bit more of an insight into who the movers and shakers are and how they operate.
And do you think they succeeded in having that sort of Red Bar feeling? Is it that casual, even compared to something like SIHH was never really casual. There was a lot of security and getting your bag scanned and then rules. And is it like that, or is it?
Absolutely. I mean, that's like going to an airport, really. I mean, it's not, you know, you get sort of patted down on your way in and you feel borderline criminal as you enter the world's premier luxury watch event. It's very much more informal than that. I mean, again, as I slightly sarcastically said in my piece, but really it's true, you could storm the barricades with a plastic fork. I mean, there are no barricades, really. There is a place where you have to wave a QR code around, which you've received on submitting your email address and registering for the event. But it's very light touch, which is great, because it feels like a nice place to be.
That really very closely parallels the experience that I had when I was there. Of course, part of the reason you could storm the barricades with a plastic fork is because the consequences of attempting to are too horrible to contemplate.
That, I think, is a fair appraisal of the situation.
I mean, I can't imagine how far you would get, down the highway outside the Dubai Financial Center if you tried to walk off with anybody's property, but I bet it's not very far.
I'm sure that's the case. But I think at the same time, and we shouldn't take too much away from the Siddiqui family, who at the same time are very warm in their welcome. You're not conscious at all of some of the restrictions that are in place in the United Arab Emirates and in Dubai. Alcohol is served on site, for example. So there are obviously a lot of restrictions around alcohol in Dubai, but they have a license and they are able to be hospitable just as we would expect were we in North America or Northern Europe or anywhere else in the world for that matter. So it's a fun place to be.
It is. The Dubai Financial Center is sort of a separate administrative district within Dubai that has its own set of rules that, again, don't necessarily apply outside it.
And, when you take all of that into account and we're chatting with other people, maybe not even just, CEOs or kind of brand bigwigs, but other people in our line of work, what's the general vibe, following a pandemic? Are people really excited to be out and doing something and eating some good food and probably drinking some good stuff and seeing some old friends? Or is there still some caution? What was the kind of feeling?
And as ever, that thing boils down to your personal choice, doesn't it, really? And naturally, there were some people who were quite content with a fist bump and not much more, and there were others who were quite prepared to throw their arms open. And I think the general spirit was one of openness. I think Omicron was only just beginning to come into the conversation 10 days ago. And so I would say it was probably the freest I felt at a watch gathering in best part of 2 years, in end of 2019, really. So in that respect, it was... joyful sounds like a strong word. I feel I should be a little bit more cynical in describing it. But overall, I'd say there was a lightness in the air and people were glad to be there. So the Siddiqui family had taken precautions to make sure that the Horology Forum was never going to be over capacity. So that, I'm not sure we can call it social distancing, really, but there were fewer seats in there than there had been 2 years ago in order to try and accommodate the fact that some people would want to be a little bit further away from others. But I think if you're going to an event like that and they're going to be thousands of people on site, you've pretty much got over your issues with COVID at that point.
I will say, to your earlier point too, Robin, the Siddiqui family are wonderful hosts. You really do feel, personally welcomed when you go there. You actually do feel like you're a guest of the family, and that's in really strong contrast, to what you were talking about, James, the experience that we all used to have at SIHH, which was, very, very high security, very formal. And, you felt taken down a peg before you even hit the showroom floor after going through all that security. And Baselworld, which could feel in its busiest years like, just this, very, very impersonal, almost a rugby scrum of a trade show. And it's one of the nice things about Dubai Watch Week in the past, when I went there in 2019, was it was relatively small scale. It did feel relatively intimate. And there were all these wonderful opportunities to just sort of, talk to people. I mean, Jean-Frédéric Dufour, from Rolex happened to walk by, and he actually said hello to me, and we talked for a little bit. And I can't imagine that happening anyplace else. I certainly can't imagine it happening at Basel World or anywhere in Switzerland.
That's it. I think it's accessible. I think that's basically what we're describing, isn't it? There's an accessibility about it which doesn't exist elsewhere. You know, someone like Fabrizio Bonoessa Stigliani, who's a very accessible person generally, but you know, he is one of those who loves being there. He loves the openness, and he loves just walking about and enjoying those chance encounters. I mean, likewise, I saw Jean-Fred Dufour there 2 years ago and shook hands with him for the first time since he left Zenith. You know, when he was at Zenith, I used to see him once or twice a year, and he's sort of been hidden away, closeted somewhere in Geneva or wherever else. And it was good to see the man in the flesh. And it would be lovely, wouldn't it, if we sort of had a little bit more access to him more broadly and could interview him once in a while. But that's not going to happen anytime soon, I doubt. But to see these people walking around was refreshing. It made it quite real.
You know, so it's something of a more impersonal show. You're getting kind of FaceTime with people that aren't always accessible at a large, maybe not only just a larger trade event, but a trade event within the confines of how the Swiss do things, which is kind of the other main context for these sorts of shows. I want to get into the watches because there's a handful of watches that were announced or kind of leveraged with the show. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about the forums. But just before we get to that, I am curious where, you know, the whole landscape of the idea of like a Swiss watch trade show has really not fallen apart, but has had some major shifts in the last few years. Do you think that this is kind of the future, or do you think as soon as it makes sense, brands are going to dive back into a giant, you know, show that has to have hundreds of thousands of people to make sense?
I want to say yes, but I think we haven't had the ultimate test, which is essentially the rebirth of Watches and Wonders. I mean, last time we went to Watches and Wonders, it was SIHH, and it was still pretty much as it ever was. There were signs they were trying to loosen it up a little bit, but I mean, as we've just described, we were herded in like cattle. I think smaller fairs and more frequent and more global is the future. There's no question of that now. I doubt all of us will go to all of them, and particularly in these times when we're all talking much more about sustainability and behaving more responsibly. And I think that's part of it too. People don't want to travel as far and as often. And so I think we will, in a few years' time, as things have settled down, we will see high frequency of events in major cities all over the world. That's what the brands want. There are all sorts of conversations happening behind the scenes that I think we're not really privy to among some brands who are at fairs at the moment and some who aren't, because I think brands, even those who aren't at fairs, do recognize that there is value in being corporate. There is value in meeting together. There is the core temperature is sustained and increased when brands meet together. There's no question of that either. So those brands who are currently flying solo, some of whom are doing so a little bit arrogantly, some of whom I think are doing out of a sense that there isn't really a better option at the moment. I think some of them will come back and will take part in events, maybe not a giant 200, 300, 400, 500 brand fair in Switzerland where 100,000 people descend on the city from all over the world. But I think we will see a reshaping, and that reshaping won't be every man for themselves.
Yeah, I think I agree with all that. And Baselworld was, it was announced, its rebirth was announced, and now it's been canceled again. And, you know, the sort of joker in the deck is how much longer is the pandemic going to go on for, and how much longer is, I think the answer to that is it's not ever going to go away. It's going to become an endemic disease that we manage well. But for the moment, it's producing a lot of uncertainty around, you know, where people can go, how many people can go to different places. They're in the middle of a sort of early winter spike in Europe right now. There are lots of travel restrictions in place that were not in place even, a month ago. And the other thing that I think is worth thinking about is that whether or not a brand chooses to participate in a group show, it really depends on I think it's going to become more and more brand specific moving forward. So, you know, for example, Audemars Piguet, for instance, just to take one example, here's a brand which is really, it's closing down its external retail channels. It's selling only through boutiques, setting up AP houses all over the globe. And I think that this is going to be the trend moving forward for at least some of the major luxury brands. They really want to take control, not just of their retail channels, but also their communication channels, their exposure channels. They want to create macro environments around their products. They don't want your perception of what Audemars Piguet is to be informed just by seeing a Royal Oak in a case, if you can ever even see a steel Royal Oak in a case. They want it to be informed by an entire environment that they've created, you know, hence the AP houses. And I think that that's probably going to be a significant trend moving forward for luxury brands. Now, smaller brands that produce at a larger scale, or even, you know, I think we're all comfortable calling Rolex a luxury brand at this point and have been for many years. There's definitely something to be gained from wider exposure. And I don't see Rolex, which, you know, has historically relied very heavily on its retail network, including the Siddiqui family, you know, for instance, who I think in any given year, they were either the largest or one of the largest Rolex retailers in the world. You know, for brands like that, it probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense to try to create the kind of highly curated micro environments that Audemars Piguet is trying to create. You know, and the third thing is that I really do think, and I hope that the industry as a whole kind of you know, sees it this way as well. I do think there is some value to be had for the Swiss watch industry to kind of get together collectively and, you know, do something that expresses sort of collective pride in the, you know, the history of horology, its, you know, sort of special place in Switzerland, its, you know, rootedness in Swiss culture, and in a larger sense for the entire industry globally to get together and do that. You know, I mean, you know, Citizen and Seiko, you know, and Casio are major, major, major watchmaking brands as well. To have them absent from any sort of a global trade show would be, you know, an enormous miss. And the thing that I always used to like about Baselworld was it really felt like, you know, while there was a lot, there's always going to be a lot of parochialism and a lot of competition, obviously, because, you know, there you are in the same room with, you know, literally hundreds of your direct competitors. But at the same time, it felt like we were all there because we all liked watches. And that's something that I miss a little bit. Well, actually, it's actually something I miss quite a lot in the current environment. I mean, not being able to do something that sort of brings everyone together, you know, under a single banner of love for these, you know, really marvelously archaic objects. You know, it's a shame that we can't do that, and I hope that it becomes possible on some scale moving forward.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate the feeling that it was to walk into the Mezzoplatz and see so many of the brands in one eye's view, like in that tunnel view down the center of the main hall of Hall 1. You know, and I'll remember every year you wait at the gates until 10 o'clock and then there's this kind of mad rush to get in there and see everything. But as you're walking in, there is this energy, and it's not a business energy. It's like a deep nerdiness that the opening press day is a really fun thing, because not only are you seeing people, it's kind of like going back to camp. That's, you know, a joke we make pretty frequently with these sorts of events, that you get to see your camp friends.
It was like Charge of the Light Brigade, but in a good way, right? Rolex to the left of you, yeah. Tudor to the right of you, Omega straight ahead of you.
But it did have this really special feeling, and I don't think that feeling was the same when you went to SIHH. I mean, aesthetically, SIHH was much different. Everything was kind of behind a facade, a literal facade, before you got in and saw. Whereas this, it was almost like all the brands were stepping forward, and it was a very, like, inviting sort of scenario, even though in many ways, unless you were in our scenario, you could kind of just walk around and push a stroller and make sure that I couldn't make my next meeting on time on a day other than press day.
But I always wanted to install journalist lanes.
Yes.
As we were sort of bolting between half hour appointments.
That and some sort of, they needed some staff with an orange vest or something, so for when you're just trying to do one 15 second stand up in front of the Rolex and there's somebody who's just standing directly over your shoulder, talking on their phone, and you're like, could you just, like, 6 inches in either direction, my man, please.
Somewhere there's a blooper reel of Stephen Pulverint at Baselworld, yeah, a few years back, and he literally, he's trying to do like five takes outside Tudor, and the same guy keeps walking right through the shot.
Yeah, it's like, come on, man. I literally need 20 seconds of peace here. That's what's required.
I think the big change is about how the brands collectively and the industry as a whole generates energy. So when I first went to Baselworld in 2004, I think it was, and as we know, the landscape has changed irrevocably since then. But in 2004, you sort of needed a Baselworld in order to show how big and powerful and sexy this watch industry was. And you walked in there and it was the only place you could feel that kind of energy. But of course, as we know, particularly over the last five or so years, the landscape has become so much broader and so much more interesting, and it can generate energy in so many different ways. And that's made the relevance of the fairs fundamentally less significant. certainly as a visitor, you know, we can tap in on a daily basis now. When I first got into this, you couldn't. There was nothing else. The fair was the high point of the year. And if there were one or two other high points during the course of the year, it was normally only for a select few. And I think that's the fundamental change that has made the, or has put the existential crisis into the watch fair business.
Yeah. And I know from a very personal standpoint, there's also, I think the first year that we didn't have to go to the shows because of the pandemic, the shows weren't running. I kind of felt like there was a reprieve, like I got a year off from, you know, what's essentially the major leagues or the all-star game or whatever. Like I'm not obviously not that tied into sports. You know, the thing that you kind of practice and got good for all year, you had to compress that into 6 or 7 days or 5 days or whatever and do it like mad. But now that it's been a little while, even beyond that, the initial pause of the shows, I do kind of miss the chance to see and shoot everything. Like just you know, look at the calendar that someone would put together and be like, I want to be in that meeting. I want to make sure I go to that meeting. And that's kind of missing. And it's not the same to get a press release. There used to be you'd get the release in your message, or they would say, oh, on this day, there's going to be a Zoom presentation. And for the first little while, you're like, this is better than being at the show. But now I think that we've lost something.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, lest we forget, I mean, we talk about, you know, the fairs having been, you know, sort of a wonderful like summer camp for, you know, for watch journalists and for the watch industry. But, you know, one very big thing that we've been missing is we don't actually get to see and handle a lot of the watches that we write about these days, you know? And I mean, that is an enormous, enormous gap. And, you know, we try to obviously, you know, I think that the three of us have been to enough trade shows and seen enough watches. I mean, I don't know what it is collectively between the three of us, but, you know, it's got to be more than 30 years, you know, and you can make very, very educated guesses a lot of the time. But the fact that you don't actually get to see product physically and take that first impression home with you, it does make life very difficult, you know, and sometimes very, very difficult.
Definitely changes the context.
Yeah. You know, I mean, people used to ask me, I would come home from Baselworld and people would say, you know, like, what were your favorite watches at Baselworld? And it's like going to Baselworld was kind of like being a, you know, like an anaconda that swallowed an entire deer.
It's like asking me which one is my favorite Cheerio from a whole bowl of Cheerios.
Well, it is just like, I mean, it takes an anaconda 6 months to digest a deer, right? And like, I always felt like it took me that long to digest what I'd seen at Baselworld.
Yeah.
But just like not actually seeing watches physically so much it's tough. It's tough.
Since its start back in 1865, Zenith has become one of the world's preeminent watch manufacturers, and the brand has been a player in many of watchmaking's greatest moments, including the historic flight over the English Channel, the creation of the first automatic chronograph movement in 1969, and even a record-setting leap for more than 24 miles above Earth's surface. Using exclusively in-house calibers, including the iconic El Primero, the 100th of a second resolution of the Defy 21 line, and the universal charm of the new Chronomaster Sport, Zenith has established itself at the nexus of style and genre-defining watchmaking. As a nod to the past that manages to reflect all of Zenith's modern watchmaking acumen, few watches represent the core of Zenith more than the El Primero Revival G381 Limited Edition. With its pink gold 38mm case and classic mid-century styling, the G381 looks as special as ever, and this 50-piece limited edition represents a tribute to the 50th anniversary of the El Primero by recreating one of the hottest vintage-inspired chronographs in a gorgeous commemorative edition. Powered by an automatic El Primero 400 movement, the G381 is a faithful homage to the golden era of sports chronographs, with a bright panda dial, a sporty red seconds hand to highlight its ultra-smooth, high-beat movement, and a special 50-year warranty. Priced at $19,200 on a black alligator strap, it's a stunning tribute with true style, substance, and collector appeal. Click the link in the show notes or visit shop.hodinkee.com to see for yourself. And now, back to the show. But hey, I mean, Robin did get to go to the show, so we at least have one hands-on experience with some of the watches, and it's good because there were some interesting watches. Robin, you think Oris is as good a spot as any to start?
Absolutely. I think we've been watching on over the last few years as Oris has almost regenerated into this really quite interesting. It's independent. It's still an independent brand. We don't think of it as an independent brand in the same way we do with so many of the micro brands, perhaps, to use that term. You know, this is a brand that's almost certainly producing sort of perhaps as many as 50,000 watches a year. I'm not quite sure, they don't publicize the number. But in the last few years, it's, I think since 2014, it's introduced, I'm going to say, nine new calibers. Obviously, most of them were derivatives of either one base caliber or another. I think they've only done two base calibers. But suddenly the story, the watchmaking story has gathered an enormous amount of pace, as has the story around the brand and the way that it's presenting itself, the way that it communicates and the way that it wants us to perceive it. And at Dubai Watch Week, we got two new watches from Oris, one of which was really quite significant. I think it's the signature Oris design, the Big Crown pointed date, which has been around, they say it's been in production without any sort of cessation since 1938. I don't know whether that's true or not, but the design is pretty familiar to people who know a watch. But of course, it wasn't chosen as the shell for Calibre 400 when Calibre 400 was introduced 12 months ago. That went to the Aquis, which was clearly a commercial decision rather than a romantic decision. But that Calibre is now inside the sort of core collection, Big Crown Pointed Date, having appeared briefly in that limited edition, 250-piece Holstein edition over the summer. And so, yes, you can now have yourself a 38mm Big Crown with this this exceptional calibre in it for, I'm not sure what it is in dollars, but in pounds, it's only £2,600, which for a watch with a 5-day power reserve and 10-year warranties and pretty impressive anti-mag specifications is a lot of watch for your money.
Yeah, it's $3,400 US. This is actually one I did get to go hands on with. They loaned it to me before it went down to New York for some photos, and I was really impressed by this watch. It's really beautiful, which isn't really surprising if you know the pointer date. But the pointer date for me, I didn't actually ever think of the pointer date as being even too big at 40mm by any stretch, but it works really well at 38. This is an especially beautiful watch. It's got this really inky blue dial that really plays with the, this is a weird statement, but if you've seen this watch in person, the blue of the dial seems to play with the AR coating on the crystal in a way that feels almost intentional rather than just... Some Breitlings used to do this where you'd get a blue steelfish and they always had their kind of purpley blue AR, and it worked in sunlight. And this works in the same way. The movement, of course, is lovely. They've got a different treatment for the pointer hand instead of the crescent indicator. It's now like a red, almost more like a GMT indication, a red arrowhead. Jack, did you get a chance to take a peek at this one? I think it was in New York because I think we're carrying it in the shop as well. So,
you know, I didn't get a chance to see it yet. I've just seen it in pictures, but you know, it's an awfully handsome watch. I mean, you know, it's a classic design. It's a classic for Oris, and it's a great example of the old saying that classics are classics for a reason.
And then the other that they offered is a brand new line, correct, Robin? This is one I haven't seen in person, just the images.
Now, this is interesting. I thought it was, but then digging around on the website, I discovered that if you dig far enough, that there has been an Oris rectangular before, but I'd never ever seen it. And it's interesting. I don't know why they've reintroduced it, but it's come in a year when we've seen a number of rectangular watches. I found myself writing a story about rectangular watches for the New York Times earlier this year. I knew the Oris was coming, and unfortunately, they delayed the launch. It was supposed to come at Geneva Watch Days and was pushed back to Dubai Watch Week for whatever commercial reason. But that's a great looking watch. It's, in mechanical watch terms, it's cheap as chips. It's very much sort of falling into line with the trend for things like the Tank Must and at the higher end, I forgot the name of the watch now, but the Langer, the rectangular Langer, the extraordinarily complicated Langer. Jack, help me out here. What's that called?
The Cabaret and the Arcade.
Thank you. Exactly. So, I tried one on. I think it looks good. I think the Bordeaux is my pick. The blue is pretty nice as well, but it's also playing into the trend for color. And Oris is ultimately a pretty kind of, it's a mainstream product because of its price point. And that, I think it's about £1,450, I think. So a little bit more than that in dollars. And it's a nice commercial introduction into their collection, which I suspect will do reasonably well without ever being a high flyer.
Well, one of the things I have always admired about Oris is just the descriptive pragmatism of their names. I mean, the Oris Rectangular is in fact rectangular.
You're not going to mix it up for a different one, that's for sure.
Just what it says on the tin.
And so, yeah, it comes in a blue, a red, a sort of gray, and then a silver dial. Different strap options. For those of you that, you know, are comparing in your mind with something like a Tank, it's 25.5mm by 38mm. Stainless steel case. And yeah, it looks like, about $1,700, $1,800. Yeah, I think this is a handsome thing. And it also makes sense in my mind because we're seeing this continued rise in popularity with things like the Cartier Tank, especially in the last, say, 4 or 5 years, even more so in the last even 2 years. they just seem to be becoming a very hot watches, even among people who aren't necessarily watch collectors.
Yeah, that's true. There's a sort of a style maven quality to the Tank, isn't there, which far transcends simple watch design and love of watch design. And it may well be playing into that a little bit. I mean, it does have a very Art Deco feel. It's got the sort of the rail track minute counters, and it feels very much of that period. But as far as I know, I don't know whether Oris actually made a watch in a rectangular shape in that time, back in the sort of 20s and 30s. They were certainly very productive years for Oris that particular season.
Yeah, the dial and hands have a sort of reverso feel to them as well, which I think works pretty well.
Yeah, very much so. The case design is pretty fantastic too. It's got a little step to the case flank on either side, which actually reminds me a little bit of the Patek Tende, of all things.
Yeah, the proportions are quite similar, aren't they? That's a fair call, fair show.
And so beyond Oris, what else kind of struck you as being, you know, interesting to chat about? Did you get a chance to see the Moser in person?
I did see the Moser in person. I have a fondness for the Cyrillic alphabet because, full disclosure, I studied Russian at university. So I when I saw it, I guess I obviously knew what it was. I knew what it said. And perhaps for some, there would have been a little bit of mystery there, a little bit of mystique. I think what I continue to enjoy about Moser is that they do a pretty good job of appearing not to care too much whether people like their watches or not. I think Edward's probably a little bit more sensitive than he lets on or likes to let on. But the response to that piece that I wrote for you guys was pretty mixed. One or two saying, nah, totally don't want that. Another saying, I think that's pretty cool. And I think Moser has that capacity to be a little bit of a, as we say in the UK, a Marmite brand, where it's quite a difficult brand to ignore. People love it. People hate it. There's not much room for any emotion in between. And this watch seemed to sort of slot right into that same spectrum. I liked it.
Yeah. So this is the Heritage Bronze, and then in quotations, since 1828 limited edition. And it's a big bronze sort of pilot effect design, if you might imagine, a kind of a classic look. And then, like you'd mentioned, the Cyrillic alphabet for the Moser logo. I think it's a handsome looking watch. Moser is a brand that in many ways, I feel people have to see in person. You know, that you can get a lot from the photos, but especially if you're getting into some of these ones with whether it be the Fanta Black dials or some of their more avant-garde expressions, they do this cool thing where they'll take a silhouette, a format that is well known, and then just iterate it in 20, 30 different directions, whether it's the Endeavor or whatever. And I think there's an expression for just about any taste. Definitely, they're not making watches that seem to care what other people are making in watches, which I give them credit for.
Yeah, I mean, if one of your products is something that is easily mistaken for an Apple Watch on the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh glance, and you're calling it the Swiss Alp watch, you know, you definitely know that you're not driving in the same lane as anybody else in the industry.
For sure. And then beyond the Moser, did you get a chance to see the Bulgari MB&F? Because that's one that doesn't necessarily, for me, this is a weird thing for me to say because I'm such a big MB&F fan. The photos, it doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. And I think probably the first thing to say about it is that it is not the Flying T. It is a completely new shape. But Fabrizio sort of took the form and did his thing. He squeezed it. He made it his own while also retaining the basic genetics of Max Boos's design. So I actually sat down with both of them in Geneva back in August to look at this thing. So I've seen it a few times now. And it's a challenging watch, perhaps, for someone like me who likes basic sort of utilitarian chronograph at a stretch kind of watches. To sit and look at something like that and try and appreciate it, because it is ultimately a jewellery watch. The setting of the stones is very much in keeping with Bulgari's Allegra jewellery collection, about which I know next to nothing. So much of the appraisal of it, I think, has to be through the lens of somebody who understands what Fabrizio has done as a jeweler. And for him, I think it was licensed to bring his two passions together in a way that he doesn't normally have the opportunity to do. So he was saying how frustrated he often is when it comes to designing a jewelry watch, because he's got so little space to play with. You can't put a great big rock in an Octo Finissimo. It's never going to be possible. Whereas when you've got a giant dome sitting over the top of a watch dial, then yeah, you can chuck four or five big stones in there and express yourself as a designer much more fully. And I think he had enjoyed the opportunity to do that. While Max had found it quite painful, as I think he does when he puts these collaborations together. He described it as a dictatorship detox because, as we know, he's a total control freak and very successfully so. But these collaborations require him to release his IP, these beautiful creations of his, and allow someone else who has a different take to reinterpret them. And that is, as a creative, something that's quite brave. I think we have to agree.
You know, it's funny, Robin. I think that this is the only watch that we're going to talk about today, or that we have talked about today, that we've both seen in person, because we actually had it here in the office to shoot. And I have to admit, I have kind of a weakness for big stones. I mean, one of the first...
Your age, Jack. You'll pass them soon enough.
Oh, gosh. One of the first... I did rather walk into that one, didn't I? One of the first people that I ever met in the watch industry was Jacob the Jeweler, Jacob Arbo, many, many years ago. And I went up to his boutique on 57th Street, and I was there ostensibly to look at the Quentin Tourbillon. And he started showing me, you know, I showed an interest in stones, and he started showing me bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger stones. And by the end of half an hour, I was holding a $26 million 16 karat pink diamond in my hand. And I was like, there's a really big guy with a suspicious bulge under his coat standing by the door. How far, you know, speaking of how far could you get down the street?
Well, it'd be like that scene where they list everyone who's ever tried to knock off the casinos in Ocean's 11.
Right.
Jack, you might've made it to the front plaza.
Right, right. This guy actually tasted fresh air. So, you know, this is all by way of saying, I find big stones, especially colored stones, you know, just kind of fascinating. There's this weird, and it doesn't feel like an entirely wholesome charm that they exert. You know, I mean, if you're susceptible to the allure of big stones at all, it really does feel as if something's getting inside your head that you don't necessarily want in there, but that you kind of can't help letting in. And for me, it goes back a long way. When I first moved to New York, I was 21 years old, and I walked into Tiffany, and the first thing that caught my eye was a pair of gigantic pigeon's blood ruby earrings. And I asked the lady, and I was wearing like torn jeans and, you know, like a t-shirt and carrying a backpack. But the nice thing was everybody there was super polite, I guess, because you never know who you're talking to. And I asked the lady behind the counter, how much are these earrings? And she said, you have a good eye, sir. These are a pigeon's blood ruby earrings from Burma. They're $350,000 for the pair, but we have them in all price ranges. So I took a look at the Allegra, and I thought, this is cool, man. Look at those stones. I think it's hilarious that Max described it as a dictator detox, because, you know, I hadn't really considered until you said that, Robin, but like, I mean, yes, he's a control freak. Yes, he absolutely obsesses about the minutest detail of every single thing that he produces. And there is not a single detail in any of his watches that he has not personally blessed, 100%. So for him to let, you know, Fabrizio, you know, go bananas with big stones on this particular watch must have been very, very difficult for him. I think the funniest, the Hodinkee Commentariat, largely disliked it, I think, because it ran so counter to what they wanted and expected from MB&F. But I loved it. I thought it was this just, you know, wonderful, wacky take, wonderful, wacky, incredibly expensive take on an MB&F. The best comment that I saw was, it's the Infinity watch, you know, like the Infinity Gauntlet, you know, with the Infinity Stones in it from the movie. Did you see the movie? Either of you see the movie?
Two faces staring stonily back at you. No pun intended.
Is that a comic book one?
It's an Avengers reference.
Ah, okay. I'm out on that combo.
I think the other thing about it, of course, is that at a business level, the business case for it's kind of extraordinary too, because Bulgari doesn't really gain anything. Financially, it gains nothing of any significance whatsoever. I mean, maybe a couple of million dollars worth of turnover, which, I mean, in Max's case, is going to be very significant for his company's turning $15, $20 million a year, something in that kind of range. So it's a significant partnership for him. But for Bulgari to go into the space, and I did catch Babin at Geneva Watch Days and asked him, why have you guys done this? You know, you don't need to do this. Clearly, a sentiment that Fabrizio echoed when I spoke to him. He described it as dangerous, actually, because he felt the potential to kind of screw up the Bulgari name was quite high. But Babin actually said that he felt that there was There was some watchmaking prowess in MBNF that Bulgari still doesn't have, despite all of its achievements over the last 10 years, and that it would help continue the narrative that Bulgari is a serious watchmaker. It is passionate about high-end watchmaking. And so I think that was a glowing commendation by Babin of what MBNF have achieved.
Bulgari has done, they have broken world record after world record, but it's been within a fairly narrow sort of horological palette, so to speak. I mean, it's been ultra thin watchmaking. That's where they sort of finally got people to take them seriously as a watchmaker, and deservedly so. But you know, I mean, they a lot of the IP for Complications, for instance, they inherited from Daniel Roth or from Gerald Genta. And one of the things that I really like about the Finissimo series is that it really feels like Bulgari. It doesn't feel like something that they have evolved from from somebody else. And I think that Babin's point, as I understand it, through you, Robin, is a good one. I mean, they actually, I mean, there are only so many records in ultra flat watchmaking you can break before it starts to seem, while impressive, a little bit repetitive. And I think that it is necessary for them to sort of branch out a little bit. And that's actually one of the things I liked about the collaboration. Also the stones.
On the note, the ultra thin records actually at Dubai Watch Week, they had all seven of them in a case together, which was pretty cool, actually. I don't think I've ever seen all seven of them together like that before. You had to look at them face on from the side. There was nothing there.
Nothing to see.
They just disappear. Like cardboard cutouts, literally. Fascinating watches for sure, and worthy owners of those records. I think we got time for at least one more look at another launch. What do you think, Robin? The Girard Perregaux stuff catch your eye?
I think we have to go there because Girard Perregaux very boldly rocked up with four new models, two of which were Laureatos, which were the two that focused my attention particularly. They put out a couple of 188-piece limited editions called, I'm going to get this wrong again, Infinity or Eternity. Let's get this right.
From Here to Eternity.
From Here to Eternity. Good. Infinity was last year, of course, with the black dials, which you could sort of look into forever. So, yes, the Eternity editions with either a blue or a green enamel dial. I don't get particularly excited by enamel dials, if I'm perfectly honest, but there was a romance and a beauty to those. And also, I think, a relatively sensible price. I mean, they were, again, I think I'm working in pounds here, about £11,500.
Yeah, $15,200 US.
Okay, that sounds about right then. Which,
yeah,
I think for that quality of watch from what is still a high end watchmaking brand with a pretty iconic design and with an enamel dial is relatively reasonable in the grand scheme of things.
For anyone who doesn't track Girard Perregaux that carefully, the Laureato is sort of their integrated steel sports watch, a la Royal Oak or Chopard's Alpine Eagle, or it's a trend, and everybody's and they got into it a few years ago, to their credit. And this is a 42 millimeter with as Robin mentioned, a really gorgeous option of either a blue or a green enamel dial, which really does kind of, it does that not high low thing, but with a steel watch that's very sporty to then have quite a resplendent dial. I think that they've done a nice job, and it feels very GP to me. To my understanding of this brand, this feels core to them, despite the fact that it's not some incredible triple bridge or what.
I'm still trying to figure out where this brand is going. What do you think, Jack? Where do you think GP is going at the moment?
Well, first of all, I have to apologize. It's just the Eternity edition. I don't know where I got From Here to Eternity. I think I'm going soft in the head.
Just writing ad copy for them now.
Yeah, exactly.
That one's free. They could take it. It's all right.
I mean, I don't know. They have such a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful heritage, from the, from the tourbillons that they made in the late 19th century up through the, the gyromatic high frequency was guaranteed, in the late 1960s to run within a minute a month, which was an extraordinary achievement at the time. It was one of the first successful commercially available high frequency watches. I've always felt the Laureato, maybe because it started out as a quartz watch in the 1970s, that might have something to do with it. But I always feel that it didn't quite get the respect that it deserves. It's a cool watch. I've actually had a couple of vintage mechanical Laureatos with GP zone extra flat movement, both of which I sold and both of which I wish I hadn't sold. And the money's got nothing to do with it. I just miss them as watches. It's hard for me to think of another brand that has so much to work with in terms of, in-house movement capacity, history, design history. The Esmeralda Tourbillon, they made an homage to it as a wristwatch, I think, for Dubai Watch Week. And I've only seen it in pictures, but it's breathtaking. And I can't quite figure out why they're having so much trouble bringing some focus into how they present themselves to the public, because all the pieces are there. You know, I mean, they've got a history and a heritage as a watchmaker, and at the very, very high end as well, that would be the envy of most other luxury brands. They have a portfolio of movements that very few other brands have, of in-house movements. So they have a manufacturing capacity. And I don't know, like, I just feel like somehow, you know, if I were to give them advice for, you know, the next 5 years, I would say, okay, 2 to 5 years. I would say over the short term, over the short to medium term, pick a couple of things and just focus on those. Because with GP, you never know what you're going to get. You could be getting a wonderful stainless steel integrated sports watch with an in-house mechanical movement. Well, you know, or you could be getting, you know, $750,000, you know, tourbillon under 3 sapphire bridges. I mean, this is part of the problem, right? There's so many things that they message about. And I think it's hard for consumers to sort of reconcile all of those things into a single brand identity. And it's not really the consumer's job to do that, right? It's the marketing department's job to figure out how to do that. And it's the brand's job to figure out how to do that.
The consumer won't do it. The consumer is far too lazy to do it. And that's their prerogative. I completely agree. I mean, my last two interactions with Giro Perrigo, one was with the Aston Martin Formula One team, and then including my interaction at Dubai Watch Week, the fourth watch was there was a cat's eye in there as well, but then there was a reworking of the La Esmeralda Tourbillon pocket watch from 1889, which was, yes, covered in enameling and all sorts of miniature this and miniature that, this sort of staggeringly high complication watch. And I can't quite bring those two things. I don't think there is a way of bringing those two things together. I'm sure the brand will tell me there is, given they've done both inside 6 months. But although they haven't, of course. I suppose the La Esmeralda Tourbillon pocket wristwatch will have been in production in some way, shape or form for maybe 5 to 10 years. And they had no aspirations to become a partner of Aston Martin in the meantime. But there is a slight schizophrenia in the story and the messaging at the moment, and indeed in the production of wristwatches, which they do need to iron out.
You know, it's funny. There's one person at Cartier who's responsible for just making sure that everything that Cartier produces, and this is a very intangible thing to say, actually feels like something that Cartier would make. And they haven't always, you know, historically, they have not always been successful at doing that. But, you know, you think about the different tank designs that have appeared since 1918. And, you know, it's very hard for me to think of one that is not an unqualified success. They all look like tanks. They're all different. You know, they're all different takes on the design. I mean, okay, maybe the Divan is not the, was not the most successful design effort that they ever put out. But like, understanding what it is, and this is a really, really hard problem to crack, figuring out what it is that makes a watch a Cartier watch, or figuring out what it is that makes a watch a Rolex watch. Like, it looks obvious in those two cases, but it's actually something that's really, really hard to do. And there are different ways of sort of making that happen. But you think of Vacheron Constantin, for example. Now, here's a company which has stainless steel sports watches, it has ultra thins, it has very, very, very high complications in its portfolio. But by and large, they all feel like Vacheron watches. They all feel like they have, they somehow have the spirit of the company, of the maison.
It's sort of the same level of focus brought to anything. It feels like it came from the same team, which I don't know that you would say for the Gerard Perregaux stuff. It's not that any one part of it makes no sense or is bad. It just doesn't feel that cohesive.
So like, it's an interesting test case, right? Like why is it largely working for Vacheron, but doesn't feel like it's working right now for Gerard Perregaux?
As a consultant, I'm just going to make a lot of money answering that question. Jack, it could be you.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe that placement's open. Who knows? Brand unification strategy manager or something like that. It would fill a business card. That's
well
for sure.
Done for not saying DNA in that little diatribe as well. I was impressed.
Yeah, kudos.
Oh, God. When I became editor in chief for Revolution USA many years ago, one of the first things I did was send out an email saying that forevermore that the term brand DNA is expunged from our copy.
That's a safe one. That's a good one to have on the you know, do not write list for sure. Well, look, guys, I don't want to take up any more of your time. I think this has been great. Robin, thank you so much for going to Dubai Watch Week and offering up a couple of great stories. Everybody can hit the links if you want to check out those stories. If you didn't get the download, there's a pretty good kind of wrist shot story that I enjoyed quite a bit and I thought was really nicely written as well. Guys, this has been fun. Thank you so much.
James, great to be here. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, James. It's always fun. And it's great talking to you, Robin. It's been forever.
Too long, Jack. Far too long. Far too long.
Well, maybe we'll get to do one of these face-to-face. I'll bring every microphone I own for that that outing sometime in the future. All right. If you're listening, enjoying the show, please tell a friend. Let us know in the comments if there's something we could change or do better, if there's a watch we missed that you wish we talked about. And other than that, sit tight and we'll chat to you again in a few days with another episode. Thanks for listening.